Well, who would have figured that we'll still be talking curling in June? Kevin, you're doing okay. Where are you now?
We're doing okay. You know, Sean and I snuck away for a couple of days here. We're just down in Canmore in Alberta, not too far from Calgary. And we just kind of snuck away and because we've been in our house for many, many months. So it's nice here to get into the mountain fresh air for a couple of days.
Hanson, have you got out golfing?
I'm just about getting there. My shoulder injury is slowly coming around. I think about another week I'm going to try to hit a few balls for what it's worth. But we're having some really good weather right now, so everything's fine.
Kev, summer's here, and it's going to end on Friday. Okay, so
it actually is. You're right, Jimmy.
Let's roll out another show, boys.
Last rock, eighth end, up by two.
I don't think I'm white.
I don't think you are either.
Oh.
It's clean. Don't kill it, Ben.
Line's really good. Line's good. Right on the button, guys.
Last stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The sweepers are watching it. Fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion. Cuts him to one. He will win his final Grand Slam, taking the Players Championship. Talk about putting an exclamation mark at the end of a career. All he had to do was cut him down. Kevin Martin can celebrate. He is a champion.
Well, here we go again, fellas. Lots to talk about, including the U.S. men's and women's nationals concluded this past weekend. There's been a lot of chat on our Facebook group this week about Canadian coaches working around the world and making other nations stronger. Some people don't like it. They don't like it. They've got different views, and some are saying, well, that shouldn't be allowed, that coaches go outside of Canada to coach. Plus, we've got a great guest coming on. Wayne Madaw is going to join us. And who doesn't like Wayne Madaw and the great story that he is and was? 10 times he's been to the Brier. And we've got a couple interesting emails, a lengthy one, but really good, that we're going to talk about. If you want to email us, we love to get them. We read a lot of them. You can email us insidecurling@gmail.com, Twitter @curlinginside, and Facebook @insidecurling. Also on Instagram @insidecurlingpodcast. So thank you all for the emails. Try and keep them short, and then you got a shot of us reading them on air. Warren, why don't you give us your take on the U.S. men's and women's nationals that happened this week? Somehow they pulled all this stuff off with COVID, but it's been great if you're a curling fan. It'll wind down a little bit now, but we'll crank up a bit in another month. So what about that sort of final event of the curling season, Warren, in the U.S.?
Yes, I think we've finally made it. We've come to the end. So in Wausau, Wisconsin, this Sunday, the finals of the U.S. Men's and Women's Championship took place. On the women's side, it took an extra end before Corey Christensen defeated Jamie Sinclair by a score of 7-6. So Christensen is the 2021 U.S. Women's Champion. Both those teams will advance to the U.S. Trials in November. They're going to be held in Omaha. And Tabitha Peterson, who you may remember represented the U.S. at the Women's Worlds this year, she's already qualified. And there'll be another event held or two in the fall to qualify three more teams. So there'll be six teams in total in the U.S. Women's as well as the U.S. Men's. In the men's side, things were a little different there. Corey Dropkin defeated Jed Brundage 7-3. Brundage, a bit of a surprise to be in that final. Dropkin wasn't. And so the two teams that qualified for the trials on the men's side were Dropkin and Brundage. And, of course, they will join John Schuster, who was there as a result of winning in 2020. And same as the women's, there'll be three more teams will qualify in the fall. So, interesting enough, of the four teams that qualified on the show last week, I suggested that probably three of those teams would be the best picks, which is Christensen, Sinclair, and Dropkin. And they came through. I had also picked Rich Ruinen, who didn't make it to the final four, but I thought watching a few of those games, possibly the best one of the week in the round robin was Ruinen against Dropkin. And a well-played game went into an extra end, and the key was Dropkin making a phenomenal run-back double, kind of angle run-back double in the ninth end to pick up two, and that was really the difference in that game. Another interesting thing to note of the U.S. Nationals and their mixed doubles Nationals, one person, Vicky Persinger, ended up playing on both the championship teams. On the mixed doubles side, she ended up winning with Chris Plies, and then she was playing second for Corey Christensen on the women's side. So she sort of became the Kerry Anderson of USA Curling by being a winner in both mixed doubles and women's. So that kind of wraps up things in the U.S. Kevin, I don't know if you had a chance to watch any of it, but what do you think about all that?
Well, I just want to mention a little bit about the youth in the U.S. We talked about it a few weeks ago, actually. Sure enough, Jamie Sinclair, I guess, is one of your, if you can imagine saying Jamie Sinclair is one of the older players. She's 29 years old. And then Corey Christensen, who ended up winning, is 26. Madison Bear actually came in third at 24. And Corey and Madison were actually teammates in the World Junior. They picked up a silver in 2016 in Copenhagen. So very young players on the women's side. And that's what I was paying attention to. I think it's just phenomenal for the U.S. program to have such young competitors. Same on the men's side. Of the four, you've got Corey Dropkin, Jed Brundage, Scott Dunham, and Luke Violette. Corey's 25. Jed Brundage was a bit of a surprise, in my opinion, to get to the final. He's 34, an older group. Scott Dunham, though, only 28. And Luke Violette, 22 years old, just a junior. So on the women's and the men's side, the teams that are coming up to the top are very, very young. So, you know, obviously you learn as you play in our sport. It's kind of like chess on ice. And to have these young players already doing well at that young age, by the time they get to 30, 32 years old, we're going to be looking at some really strong U.S. curlers on both the men's and women's side. So, you know, for me, Warren, that's something that just really came out this week. You know, we talked about it a few weeks ago, but it's always interesting when the championships happen. Will the young people be able to keep up with the older crowd? And they certainly were able to in the last week.
Warren has pointed out in the past, Kevin, that the age of Canadian curlers, high-performance curlers, is kind of old to other places. And you bring up the U.S. of having really young curlers. Is there something, Kevin, that sticks out for you why the U.S. is having younger curlers having more success than perhaps Canadian ones?
The way I see it, when I go down to teach curling schools and curling academies, a ton of young people come out to these academies. So I'm not exactly sure why, if it's maybe an interest thing in the younger group for some reason, that in Canada, say if I go to do an academy in a city, we'll get a few kids out, but it'll be a lot of adults coming out. Not super old people, but older people. In the States, it's the opposite. They're much younger, and I don't know why. I don't have an answer, but they do have a lot of academies and clinics to learn to curls, and maybe a lot of these young athletes are coming out of that. But I would like to hear Warren's opinion, because it seems to be pretty clear. The group that are winning in the U.S. are say age to the group winning in Canada, substantially younger. And obviously that has to be healthy for the future, I would think. Warren?
Well, I think overall in the United States, there's a little different attitude about curling down there, and it's attractive to young people. They're intrigued by it. It's kind of mesmerizing. They are curious, and they want to play it. They want to try it. And I think it's a little different than it is in Canada. I think the other situation that's maybe a little different with the USCA. They changed their whole approach to how they select or put teams together after the 2014 Olympics, which to some degree was after strong suggestions from the U.S. Olympic Committee that some things had to change. So they sort of, their high-performance players are work as a group, and they move their players around between teams and teams if they think it's necessary. And I think when Phil was on with us last week, he more or less said that they sort of, they're working as a high-performance group rather than just individual teams. And I think that's kind of helped things as well to bring things along with the younger people. And they've also always brought their juniors up. Their juniors, I think, have played in the U.S. Nationals now for quite a few years, the junior champions, just to give them some experience. And I think it's a little different in Canada, where it's very hard for our younger teams to get in the Canadian Championship, depending upon where they live, and also to get up to the next step from where they are when they're juniors. And we've talked about that a lot in the show in weeks gone by, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a lot going forward.
So let's talk about coaching. We've got different opinions from people. I don't see how people can step up and say, Canadian coaches shouldn't be allowed to coach abroad. It seems ridiculous to me, but I could be wrong there. Like I say, people have weighed in on this topic, and not everyone thinks the way I do. There's many people out there, Warren, who say, man, they shouldn't be allowed.
Well, this is nothing new. It's gone on for years, and there's been criticism about it for years. I can remember as far back as the first European team winning a world championship back in 1975 in the way of Otto Danieli from Switzerland. And Otto Danieli had been coached by Ray Turnbull. So all of a sudden, I remember being in arenas where people were screaming, Turnbull, this is your fault. And certainly back in even in those days, Turnbull was doing work around the world. I was, and so was Wally Urszalak. And we were teaching people in other countries and bringing them to the point where they could be competitive at the world level. Back in the 60s and 70s, the World Championship, there was a lot of teams that were pretty on the edge. And I think the fact that Canadians have helped develop in these other countries is why the sport is where it is today. So I don't see any issue with it whatsoever. If a coach has developed themselves and they're good and they want to go and work with another country, that's their decision. That's up to them. If Curling Canada wants to bring any of those coaches, they can negotiate agreements with them if they wish. It's an open territory, free world. I mean, we've been exporting hockey coaches around the world forever. Most of the coaches in the NHL have always been Canadians up until a few years ago. So I don't see any issue with it. And Kevin, I'm sure you probably look at it the same way.
Well, I guess what I'd like to look at is from the eyes of, say, a curling program. Let's say the Japan curling program. Well, if you want to get coaches, curling is fairly young in that country. So if you're going to pick up a really good coach, well, where would you go? Where are you going to go to find the very best coach you can? Well, right now you've got J.D. Lind running the Japan curling program and Connor Nedjevin, of course, working there as well. So you've got two Canadians actually in Japan. You've got Peter Gallant working in South Korea. You've got, of course, over the years, both Marcel Rock was in China. Mike Harris was in China. As far as U.S., you've got Don Bartlett, my lead for years. He was down there working with Schuster. Al Hackner, of course, working in the U.S. Ed Lukwich, Wayne Madaw, of course, in Sweden. Lainey Peters down in the U.S. So there's tons and tons of examples of all these top Canadian curlers going down and helping out in all kinds of countries. And it just makes sense to me that if a country wants to get better at a sport, and curling being, you know, Canada's big game for a long, long, long time, why wouldn't you go to that pool to find your instructors and your coaches? It makes sense to me. So I don't see the reason for, well, I do see, I guess I shouldn't say that. You do see the reason why people are complaining is because, you know, Canada's not winning as much as we used to. So we just have to pick up our game a little bit, make sure our coaches that are here are able to compete with the coaches that are over there. And that, you know, because the athletes are always going to be strong. No matter which way you look at it, the athletes are going to be good. It's just a matter of giving them the resources to be able to keep up worldwide. And you know, right now, I think we certainly might be, you know, we're certainly losing our grip a little bit, and we might even be falling behind in some cases.
I understand completely that you know, any country would want to get the best coaches, and as you point out, they probably come from Canada so far. And I guess the question is, Kevin, how come these coaches are not being picked up by Canadian teams? Do they get paid more dough, Kevin, or something? Or why is it all those names you just mentioned aren't coaching provincial teams or other high-performance teams here in Canada?
Well, the program would be who picks up the coaches going overseas, be it the whatever program, be it the Japan program or whatever the case may be, the U.S. program, they're being picked up by the program. So that would, in Canada, that would be Curling Canada. And I guess it's up to them who they want to approach to coach our national teams. It's not just trying to coach, you know, Brad Gushue. Well, you know, there's not a lot Brad Gushue needs out of a coach, but we could certainly need help when it comes to our young athletes and having training camps across Canada at a young age, at 14, 15 years old, not 25 years old. Like, let's get our top instructors into these regional junior camps with the young curlers and try to keep our are teaching somewhat consistent across our country. We do our curling academies in the summer, and what we notice is that kids will come for 4 or 5 years in a row, ones that are really wanting to be strong in our sport. And we have a certain teaching regimen and just, you know, the way we like to see the rock thrown. And the kids will come back in the next year and we go, well, what happened? Well, my coach doesn't like that. You know, he'd rather have this. Okay. So the problem is we've got coaches and instructors across Canada, not all teaching the same at all. Well, that's difficult too, because now the young athlete, you know, you imagine a hockey player going to camps in Saskatchewan, BC, Ontario, if you really want to get good at hockey, and they're teaching all kinds of different ways. Well, the poor kid comes back confused. Well, what am I going to do? And that's something that happens in Canada a lot with curling. There's no real teaching manual for all coaches and instructors across Canada. And that is a problem. And we need to fix that in Canada. We're not as strong as most countries when it comes to instruction of our young athletes, just because a lot of our instructors and coaches who are good hearted and really want to do the best for the athletes, but they're not all preaching from the same book.
Kevin, have you ever been approached about coaching a team? And if so, would you consider it, or where are you at with that?
I've been approached, yes, not from anybody in Canada. Of course, I help Botcher a little bit, and if they have any trouble or whatever, they want me to come out on the ice, no problem. But other than that, not in Canada. No, definitely quite a lot elsewhere. But I've got a lot of oars in the water all the time, so I don't have a lot of time for that. Yet, but that doesn't mean that someday I won't. I would love it for sure. You know, I totally love our game and would enjoy that. But I do a lot of teaching, a lot of instructing all over the place, just not with one particular program or one particular team.
Warren, when did coaching become so big in curling? Did you guys have one when you curled back, you know, in the 70s? Tell us when there was a time that said, okay, this coaching thing's becoming the real deal.
Well, I was involved in creating the first program. So back in the 70s, the Curl Canada program came into existence, and I was charged with the responsibility of pulling everything together to develop, first of all, an instruction aspect. And so at that point, we actually had an instruction program that certified people up to 3 levels. It was in existence Canada-wide for many years, and it's just sort of seemingly has disappeared. And again, as Kevin has suggested, this is really needed. I think we need a standard for what is the approach that we use that everybody kind of agrees, yes, this is the best way to do things in every aspect of the sport, particularly the delivery. The coaching segment, we started to develop with the Coaching Association of Canada, the first level one coaching programs back in about 1977. And sort of at that point in time, it was directed pretty much at the juniors. It wasn't a thing that happened at all with the men's or women's side of things. I actually, as an experiment, because I was the person that was putting all this together, coached Lindsay Sparks' team for 4 years when they won 2 Canadian championships back in the 70s. And it was a learning experience for me because I had football coaching background of about 8 years, but no one had ever coached curling. So that was the beginning of us starting to put a program together as to what the coaches in curling do. By the mid-80s, a number of curling teams started to, at the men's and women's level, start to use coaches to some degree. And it slowly started to catch on. But that was the start of it, was the 70s. And it was primarily initially aimed at the juniors.
Will a bunch of teams curl now, Kev, after this long season? Will they practice for the next couple months before this thing cranks up? Probably September, I guess, right? Before events start again?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was on a call with Brendan Botcher on a different topic the other day, and it does sound like there'll be some curling. Hopefully, you know, as long as COVID, you know, is going the direction that it seems to be going. Hopefully, there'll be some curling in August. So I think curling's pretty much done for the summer now. We are into June, so hopefully it does. Curlers have to have a break. But it looks like because of the Olympics next year, the curlers want and maybe in some cases need to get on the ice a little bit earlier than normal, because they've got to build up to be able to compete at their best in December in Canada for the trials, and depending on what country you're from, to be ready in the late fall to be able to compete towards trying to get to the Olympic Games.
Kevin, to curlers these days, do they have to, you know, you said they do need a break, but are the better curlers, Kevin, sort of keeping to a routine over the summer months?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Jim, actually. Most times, curlers, yes, there definitely is a summertime routine, because curling is really a lopsided sport. You're using one side of your body. It's a lunge position for throwing, sweeping. You've got your one hand doing a lot of the work, depending on which side of the rock you're on. So when it comes to your summertime break, usually curling is done in April, sometimes maybe early May, but usually by the end of April. So you've got the month of May to relax, or most of the May to let your body just relax. And then you body balance for the first while in the summertime, say the month of June, half of July, you're body balancing in the gym. Then you're going to build for a month or 6 weeks, build muscle, and then you get ready for season. Okay. But in this case, now we're already into June and the curlers just finished. So they're going to have to take off at least 3 weeks, almost to the end of June. And then now you got to body balance. You can't do that in 3 weeks. It's not possible. So you've got to take a month at least. Okay. Well, now we're to the end of July. Well, now you're going to build muscle. Well, no, we're going to start curling August 15th. Because it's such a weird year that we're ending late and starting early because of the Olympics, curlers are not going to have their summertime routine the way it normally is. They're going to have to speed everything up. And that, of course, is worrisome from the coaching perspective, and that's injuries. It's worrisome, but it is what it is. With COVID, I'm so grateful that they got in all the events in the Calgary bubble and in Aberdeen, and now the U.S. Nationals all were able to get completed. That's fantastic. So it'll be interesting to see how some of the teams handle it during the summertime. We'll get some athletes on when we start, you know, in the August shows, to just hear what they did in this regard, because it's really important.
So we got a couple of emails. Let me save the funny one. Okay, we got two of them. I want to save the funny one for last. It's about Guy Hemmings. That's when I fell in love with curling, when this guy came along. No one will ever forget when the lights went out, he changed the score. But Lynn Marsh writes us first. Hello to Inside Curling and the podcast crew. As a huge curling fan, Team Gushu, I would like to thank you for what you add to the game of curling and how much I've learned about the game and the players since you've started this. Well, thank you. I just listened again to your interview with Brad this past week, and I totally agree with him on the six rocks for mixed curling. I've become a big fan of mixed curling only in the past year or two. It's so interesting, exciting, and fast-paced. I do believe that even numbered rock throwing for the men and the women on the team would enhance the game. Just my opinion, but wanted to express it. Thanks again for such an entertaining curling season. I look forward to much more. Warren, you want to go first?
Well, Brad brought this up to us a couple of weeks ago, and we talked to him from Aberdeen, and I've thought about it quite a bit. I'm not sure whether I agree with six rocks or not. It increases the length of the game a bit. It will change a few things. It's one more to sweep. But after thinking through it, I thought, if in fact this was the route to go, I wouldn't do it as Brad suggested, which is each player alternating 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What I would still set it up with one player throwing the first rock and the same player throwing the fifth and sixth stones, and the other player throwing the three in between, because this was the original concept that we thought of with this game, was to make it so it's a little off the norm and that you can change. If you decide that you've got a better advantage by switching who's throwing 1, 5, and 6 with 2, 3, and 4 at any point in time in the game, you can do that. And I know that hasn't been a commonplace with it, but it has happened with some teams. I noticed that the American team this year, Joe Polo threw first and fifth. And I think one other team in the world, mixed doubles, did as well. So if it goes to six rocks and discussed it, that's the way I see it.
Kevin, what do you say?
I really like mixed doubles the way it is. I think it's fascinating. I love watching it. It's exciting. I do see some switching, but to Brad's point, the males generally throw the middle three rocks, so that's true, but not always. And it's still in its infancy. It's a very young sport yet. So I'm not sure. Like, I kind of would leave it the same for a while. I don't think I would switch anything with it for now, because, boy, is it gaining in popularity, and it's growing like crazy worldwide. So, we're starting to get our top athletes in Canada playing it, and that was a concern in the last Olympics. A lot of our top players didn't play it much. They're starting to play it more. So I think let's just hang on. Let's just wait a little bit. It's going very, very well. Let's not change a thing that is showing great improvement and growth right now. So let's just kind of keep it the way it is for now.
Robin Henry passes on this story. I was helping out at the volunteer rally and uniform sizing event in Kitchener for the 2003 Scotties. Not sure why, but Guy Hemmings was there shaking hands and schmoozing. Many people attending knew who he was, but some didn't. Some people not familiar with him didn't know who Guy was because he was wearing a name sticker that said, "My name is Kevin Martin." The best part was he was also signing autographs as Kevin. Maybe you had to be there, but I found it quite amusing to see him work the crowd. Quite a character. Great shows, fellas. Keep up the great work. That's hilarious, Kevin. I love that.
I have a great deal of respect for Guy Hemmings. I like him a lot, and I remember that. But I do know why he was there. So back in 2001, to get the changes in the sport that we wanted, and it eventually turned into a boycott of the Breyer and various events. But Guy Hemmings was approached to not sign into the Grand Slam group, and if he was willing to not sign, he would be given a 3-year Guy Hemmings curling tour gig worth a lot of money. I'm not going to say how much money. So Guy phoned me, actually, because it meant a lot to him to see the sport grow. He wouldn't sign the deal if it mattered to us getting the Grand Slams off the ground. So he phoned me and said, "Kevin, this is what's going on. But I won't do it if it hurts." So we got together and even with Guy not coming on board with the Grand Slams, he could do this deal and we could still get the deal done with the Grand Slams and carry forward. So I just got a huge amount of respect. Guy would have walked away from a ton of money for the betterment of the game, but he didn't need to. So he ended up signing a 3-year deal, promoting curling and teaching curling, the Guy Hemmings Curling Tour, which was hugely popular and a great thing. And of course, Guy is such a character. And that was in 03. He signed the deal in 01 with Curling Canada. So that would have still been inside the 3-year deal to show up in Kitchener and promote curling and do what Guy does best, and that's have fun. And that's exactly why he would have been there. And yes, I remember that he wore the Kevin Martin thing, and we had a good laugh about that too. But what a character. Yeah, a great guy to have in our sport.
Okay, we can't keep him waiting any longer. Time to bring on Wayne Madaw. That familiar sound, footsteps coming down the hallway. We're talking about the great curler, and he was absolutely the darling of the Breyer this year, Wayne Madaw. How are you, Wayne?
I am fantastic. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You came back from an awful ski accident a few years ago, went into the Breyer because Glenn Howard had an accident, so you replaced him, and then you had this fantastic run. Talk about the ski accident, I guess, Wayne.
It was flat out a freak accident, Jim. It was, I've skied my entire life, skied all over the world, longer than I've curled. And we're members of a ski club over here near our house. And my daughter and I just decided, you know what? Let's just go out at nighttime, ski a few runs, just get some exercise. And being a young girl that she is and somewhat adventuresome, she took me through the train park, which I've done 1,000 times before. I got a little bit aggressive on a 3-meter jump, which isn't very big. And I landed a little wrong, to say the least, and literally snapped my tibia and fibula right straight across the top of the ski boot, and it went up and down my leg, so there wasn't much left there.
I mean, when it happened, Wayne, you've had such a long career. Your first Breyer, I mean, you were in your early 20s, I guess, right, when you were curled in your first Breyer?
30 years ago, 1991, some guy, Kevin Martin, won that year.
Yeah, there we go. So after the accident, I mean, certainly looking like in paper and from what you tell us now that there'd be no comeback at all. You're a fanatic skier. You're a really good golfer. I heard you shot 70 the other day too, a bird told me. Is that right?
That's not bad, yeah. That's not my first game of the year. I was pretty impressed with that.
coming back to curling, though, Wayne, was that a tough decision? Once you broke your leg, you must have looked at this thing saying, okay, I'm done. I know you're retired work-wise. Walk us through your mindset there when it all happened.
Jim, I had no intentions of coming back and playing competitive curling ever again. Right until Scott Howard called me and said, my dad's smashed up his snowmobile, we need a skip. And I said, are you sure there's not anybody better you can find? So when Glenn started his recovery, him and I talked about it a fair bit. I said, Glenn, I'm not even sure I can play 8 games, 12 games, 14 games, whatever it may take. If we're going to go, we're going to try and win this thing. So we kind of put together a practice schedule. You know, I had curled my one game, not even one game a week. I was about one game every 2 or 3 weeks. It took me a few days to recover after that. And so we started off on a slow schedule of riding the bike a little bit more at home and then throwing rocks twice. You know, I only had 5 weeks. So we started with throwing rocks twice a week, then 3 times a week, then 4 times a week. And then it was time to leave for the Briar. So, you know, I commend Glenn a lot for how he prepared not only me to deal with everything, but the team as well for, you know, what were going to be the ups and downs of a difficult week. But I'll be the first person to say it's very different playing a Briar with no expectations. All my life I've gone to the Briar with expecting to win, to be there Sunday afternoon. And this year we went and my only thought was, you know, I hope I don't embarrass myself and I hope the team plays great and I can make a few shots and we can, you know, maybe make it till Sunday. It was a very different goal, that's for sure.
When you started the run, when you started going pretty good, at what point during the Briar did you say, hey, we got a shot here?
I'm going to tell you the exact moment was in the fourth end against John Epping. We all started thinking we could do well in this thing. And then all of a sudden we missed a few shots and gave up a four ender to John Epping and came crashing back down to earth very quickly. As soon as you think you're good enough to compete against those guys on a day in, day out basis is when they straighten you out and tell you, no, you're not really are. you're not anymore.
We saw Glenn there, of course, at the end of the sheet. And I was always curious about who does most of the calling during that game. Was it you or Glenn, or how much communication did you guys have during each game?
All the practices we had beforehand, I said, you know what, I call a different game than Glenn. And the team came to me and said, well, we play a different game than you. And I said, well, I'll try and merge the two together. But at the end of the day, I'm the guy who has to believe in what's right and what's wrong. And as we kept winning games, the team bought in more and more. And Glenn was the best coach ever. He supported me 100%. When the team spoke up and said, you know what, we don't think this is right, Glenn always said, you know what, whatever Wayne thinks is right, is he's the guy throwing the last two shots and calling the game, we better side with him. So I can't thank Glenn enough for, I think he was an outstanding coach. He really excelled in that role and took it on 100%.
During the whole Briar, Mike Harris and I kept in touch with each other talking about, I guess, you know, we talked a lot about skipping 101. And I think this is good for all the young kids that are listening to this show. And that's not being one-dimensional. So I'd like you maybe touch on this a little bit, if you could. It seems easy when you watch it, but it's really not easy to perform it. And that's being able to look at the situation, look at the scoreboard, and figure out, I guess, a path forward during ends. And that's what I really enjoyed. You didn't start every end with a corner guard. You didn't start every end in any certain particular way. But by the end of the end, you got your deuce, your three set up.
Well, Kevin, I'm going to say, you know, for better or for worse, I think the game has taken that one-dimensional look that you talk about. And I think it's become the players has become so good at making every shot. Mostly the run back is the big one, right? Is the teams kind of set up the ends the same way? They throw a corner guard or they throw the center. They play the freeze. The other team plays the freeze. Depending how it sets up, then they start running the back. So I've, you know, just because I didn't curl for 5 years didn't mean I didn't watch. And I worked on a strategy that kind of took that shot away. And the way you take that away is eliminate guards. And so I didn't feel I needed to throw corner guards. You could set ends up differently. As much as the freeze is a shot that 99% of the guys can pick out when you play a freeze, but it's more effective than the run back in today's game, because when they make the run back and stick it with their own rock, all of a sudden they're one buried. Whereas when they're picking out the freeze, it still leaves you a chance to play an offensive shot on your next one rather than trying to play a defensive one. So the one thing I focus on when you talk about that is, how do I change the other team's shot so I can continually play offensive shots rather than defensive shots against them.
I guess that's a good way of putting it, because I think the years that you weren't playing at a high level, the game has changed a little bit. And I think people thought you were a little unconventional. And of course, I look at it going, well, no, it's totally conventional. It makes a lot of sense to me that you don't always have to go around that center guard. You can always freeze to something. You can always come around something in the back four to the back 12, something that nobody does anymore. There's lots of options you can do, and you're not forced into this playbook. Maybe it's because junior curling, they tend to, the young kids have a playbook, and it's kind of drilled into their head that you have to do this. It's like a dance. Instead of, I guess, the way you and I were taught to play, and that's just a school of hard knocks, where you make a call and you go, well, that was dumb. Okay, I won't do that again. And you keep doing it 1,000 times.
I'm going to put on my coach hat there for a minute, and I'm going to agree with you, and nothing against all the coaches, but I almost feel, watching as my kids have both grown up through it in the last 10 years through junior curling, I almost feel teams are overcoached. And the coaches literally have to step back a little more and let the teams play and let them, exactly what you just said, win and lose from the school of hard knocks. And you'll remember, you know, the games you won, but you'll really remember the games you lost if you made the call rather than the coach made the call.
I think one interesting question, and Wayne, we asked our listeners to send in some questions, so we have a few, but I think this one is an interesting one from Alan Batchin in Colorado. And I have the same question. Are you going to keep playing? Are you going to come back to the competition? And his says, this is a request. He wants you to come back. So are we going to see Wayne Madaw out there again next year?
You know what? I love the game, and I love competing, and I love the challenge of thinking through ends. I enjoyed that so much, being part of the Brier and getting the opportunity to play the best teams in the world again. But the simple answer is no, I am not planning to play at all ever again. To go a little further with that is, I normally match the team's rocks at the World Championships, Team Hasselbergs, and more than once I tried to slide and could not take a slide. My knees were still not recovered from 12 games at the Brier. So when it takes you more than a month to recover from 12 games, that's somebody telling you that, you know, you're only given so many slides in your life, and I've used all mine up.
This is more of a probably statement than a question, because you're kind of unique, and I don't think anyone else holds this distinction. You've won 3 world championships, which we don't have many Canadians who have. But the interesting thing is you've played second, third, and skip. Different position each time you've won. Of those 3 positions, which one do you like playing the best?
Oh, it's really hard. You know what? I enjoyed every one of them because they were at different stages of my life. You know, I enjoyed the learning experience I had playing second for Russ and Glenn. We played against, you know, Ed Lukwich, Ed Wernick, Al Hackner, Kevin Martin every weekend. And, you know, when you played Kevin, it was up and down the sheet. When you played Wernick, it was a million guards in play. So you learned so many things. It was truly a great experience in my life. From there, I moved on to skip, and I love that. And I still love that because you get to be involved in the strategy part of the game. And that's like what Kevin said, you get to think the ends through and how you're going to deal with every situation. And then the third was at a time in my life when, you know what, I didn't want to be that guy that was at the other end. I just wanted to be the guy who could help a team win games. And they fit me into a role there between Brent and Craig and Glenn where, you know, they had already won. They were a fantastic team long before I came along. And, you know, they let me just gel right in there to Richard's Hart position. And it was a ton of fun. So I can't pick one favorite, Warren. It was just truly a treat to play all of them. And it was one of those things that I think, because of that, helps me be the coach I am today, because I understand the role of every position on the team.
Hey, when it comes to playing, I just want to bring back a memory for Wayne when he was curling. He was throwing skip rocks. This is in Ottawa. And you missed your last shot. It was an intern tap and ticked the guard and kaboom on the sideboards. And the broom wasn't made good enough. I think the wood must have been rotten or something. So the broom breaks into about, I don't know, 4 or 5 pieces. So of course Wayne stomps off the ice to the dressing room mad. But there's this little kid. He might have been, I don't know, maybe 6. And he was standing by the door, but you didn't see him. He was little wee. And you headed right by. So I went out on the ice and I picked the biggest piece of the broom that was left. It was the head and maybe 2 inches of shaft. And I went and grabbed it, and I took him by the hand, and I brought him into the dressing room to get an autograph from you. Do you remember that situation? Because that little boy was so happy, because you, of course, changed right away. As soon as he walked in the door, you changed completely and welcomed him in, and oh, man, that was terrific.
I think I may even know who that kid was. He's a friend of my daughter's now. And you know what, Kevin, it's just one of those things that, you know, everybody has their own way to park their disappointing performances. And one thing I, you know, people say, you can't do that. I say, well, it's my own way to, you know, kind of put it behind me. I have my little time of myself, and then I move on.
You know, but you changed immediately as soon as you saw this little fellow walk in. And it went from Wayne, really angry Wayne Madaw, to really nice Wayne Madaw. Oh, come on in. Yeah. Of course. And the little guy brought up that piece of broom. It was only a little bit of it left, but it was a classic Wayne Madaw moment.
I've signed more than one piece of broken broom in my life.
Hey, Wayne, I got a question for you. You've been to many bars, 10 of them. You've probably seen, I don't know how many different formats over your time. And what is your take on the Brier, and what should the format be after you've looked at all sorts of them? Do you like the way it is now? You got a couple of pools. That it was never that way probably when you started. What say you about that?
I was one of the people that was a traditionalist. I liked the original format because that's what I grew up watching, that's what I grew up playing. But I actually felt this format was better this year. I didn't mind it at all. The 18 teams, the two pools and nine, you know, the top four out of each pool make it. Then you play the best teams in the other pool. There's less meaningless games. I just came from a world championship where we played a 13-game round robin. So like there was draws where not one game meant anything. You know what? It's very difficult to watch. It's very difficult to prepare your team for. The more meaningful games play, the better. So I didn't mind this year's format at all.
Well, let's talk about the, I guess, definitely you want every game to be meaningful. There's no question about that. And the 13-game round robin, let's talk about that a little bit from the Worlds, because that is a lot of games. To find a champion, to have the cream rise to the top and find out who your best team is that particular week, I just don't think it takes 13 games. I just don't know if we need to have as many countries involved either when it comes to the Worlds, but that's really up to the World Curling Federation. But if they want to continue to expand, then maybe they need to look at more two-pool system, or maybe the World Curling Federation needs to look at a multi-pool existence from tier A to B to C to D, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, like they do with the Europeans, they do that, and it's hugely popular over there. Like you have the two pools, and it worked out really well because the teams at the bottom are playing not to get relegated to the B pool, and the teams at the top of the B pool are playing to move up. So it made every game interesting at the Europeans. I actually very much like that format too, Kevin. I think that's a good way to do it. And I understand what the World Curling Federation, they're trying to introduce new countries to greater competition, but there's other ways to do it than at a World Championships where teams are getting beat 18-1.
Yeah, I think it will change. I think what they're facing right now, and they're just trying to get through some time, is to go to, right now, seven teams from Europe are in the World Championship. And of course, there's been growing pressure from Asia and the fact that now you've got three teams there pretty much on an annual basis that are going to be contenders. And then you've got USA and Canada. So as soon as you start looking at what is a probably likely pool scenario, which is 10 teams, you're going to cut out a couple of teams from Europe. So I think that is the challenge. But I think the move they made with mixed doubles this year kind of suggests where things are going to go. They are going to start to reduce the size of those pools. There's going to be teams going up and going down. And I think it's just a matter of time that the same thing is going to happen at the world level, which I agree with Kevin and you, Wayne. It's what needs to happen.
I'd like to hear your crystal ball here, Wayne, just what you see when you get at your kitchen table and have a seizure or two, and you've got your curling crystal ball in front of you. What exactly you see in our interesting sport right now, with the growth in Asia and the U.S. being incredible, I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts on where do you see this sport going when it comes to world play, World Cups, and just growth in general?
Like I hear of curling clubs opening in the U.S., all around the U.S. and in places that you never think of, Southern California, and in I think in Florida and Palm Beach somewhere, they're opening a club. So that's that's great news. And the more people that play, the more competition you're going to have. From a house league type of view, I think that is fantastic for growing the game. I think that's where it has to happen. From a competitive point of view, I think it's really good the way we are. The fact that Canada's not winning, it's more the players just not performing when the time comes. As much as I'm not trying to say that Kevin Martin was better than, you know, than Brendan Botcher, but, you know, Kevin Martin was able to win competitions. Like when it came to the Olympics, he performed. You know, it never hurt that he had John Morris, Ben Hebert, and Mark Kennedy playing in front of him. Again, not to say Brendan's team's not as good, but when it came down to it at the world level, whether they were overcurled or undercurled or with the bubble thing and everything else, they didn't perform as well as they did at the Brier and in when they won three slams in a row at the World Championship. And, you know, it's when the lights come on, the TV comes on, and you got the Canada flag on your back, it's performing your best.
Let's talk about coaching. You're a coach of a really good team in Hasselborg. And first of all, how did that all come together?
They actually reached out to Sherry first. And they said, you know, is it okay if we call your husband and ask him to have a coaching tryout? How do you feel about your husband spending, you know, traveling around the world with the five Swedish women? And she's like, good luck. Take him away. Get him out of here. And that was just after, you know, a couple years after I'd broken my leg. So I think she was pretty happy to get me out of the house and get me doing something else. So I literally had a tryout with Team Hasselborg, and you know, it was a two-way tryout. Is I wasn't prepared to coach a team that was high maintenance. They're the most routine, normal ladies that I've ever hung around, which is fantastic. And it worked out to be a great relationship. And we had a great first weekend together, and we've built from there.
I've talked to Anna a little bit about it and how important your role as far as strategy and thinking the game through, because obviously you walked into a team that could always shoot high percentage.
Hey, Kevin, they won the Olympic gold medal before I joined them. So they're really good long before I came along.
But didn't Anna want to maybe get a little help strategically with maybe having a few more rocks in play and playing a little more aggressively?
And there's a lot of little things we've worked on like that. And I came in, there was, you know, we didn't hide behind anything. Basically, we said, you know, this is what I can bring to the team. This is what I can help you do. And if that works for you guys, great. And they said, this is what we're looking for. And like I said, both those things matched up. One of the things that I'm very proud of is that I've helped them be able to find ways to win games when they're not at their best. And that's one of the things that really takes a lot of skill and talent from mentally to physically. And they won a couple Grand Slams last year. Well, they'll be the first to say, you know what, we felt we were barely at our B game, but we converted that into a game where we could compete with anybody. And they said that's one of the big things is being able to play. And as everybody knows, you're 100% every time you walk on the ice, but it's a matter of trying to find ways to win when you're not 100%.
Wayne, there's been some, I don't want to say controversy, as a coach, you know, and being a Canadian, and some people are looking at this going where they're a little pissed that we're losing Canadian coaches, or Canadian coaches are going to curl over in Europe. And some of them are saying it shouldn't be allowed to that extent. Did you have choices when it came time, when you got asked about going to coach for Hasselborg? Had other teams approached you? And what are your thoughts in this thing about Canadian coaches coaching abroad?
Well, this year at the Ladies World Championships, of the six teams that qualified for the Olympics, five of them had Canadian coaches. So, you know, nobody's getting rich off curling in any way, direction, as I know Kevin and Warren will tell you that. It's something you do for the love of the game. I had an opportunity to coach a few other teams, and it just worked out that Team Hasselborg, again, was the right fit. They wanted the skills that I brought to the team, and they were the team that I wanted to coach. So it just happened to be the perfect fit. You know, Sweden, Switzerland, Russia, whatever it is, I look at them as Team Hasselborg, and I'm lucky to be part of that team, and we'll do everything I can to help them win curling games.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on, Wayne. You've got lots of stories. When I first met you, you were the bad boy, okay, of curling. All you did, Wayne, was flip someone the bird, and the thing went viral for about 10 years after that.
He didn't flip somebody the bird. He flipped the entire crowd the bird.
No, Kevin. It was only one bank of people.
Give us one or two of your funniest experiences. We've had some guests on and had some great stories about all sorts of things from players away from the game or even on the ice. How about you, Wayne?
Oh, there's a million stories. You know, my favorites probably always revolve around Skins games. We were lucky enough to go to a lot of Skins games, but this one was with back when we were playing with Joe Franz, who everybody knows had his own issues. And the night before, they draw for practice times. And we had the afternoon game, which was 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Gimli. And we drew the morning practice, which was 8 a.m. So Scott Bailey and I, who had been to enough Skins game, immediately looked at each other and said, well, the ice changes from practice to real, so we're not going to practice time. Well, Joe's trying to be the good guy because he was new to the team. He says, well, Graham's going to go, so I'm going to go with Graham. Well, Joe and Scott and I went out and enjoyed everything the Skins game has to offer the night before. Everybody shows up for their 8-8. Like, the teams that practice after us, it was Paul Trulson. Kevin, do you remember him?
Yeah, thanks, Wayne.
some guy named Furby was there as well. And then we got to actually play your old second, I think, who was skipping a team. So we
Dan won Petrick.
The McCain, yep. Yeah, Petrick. He won the McCain Spiel to qualify. So that was our draw, too. So things were going our way. And so, like I say, Trulson and Furby and Petrick, their teams are all there at 8 o'clock. And Graham and Joe show up for practice, not Scott and I. Graham goes out, starts throwing rocks. Joe throws one rock and then lays down on the backboards and has a sleep. Graham throws 12 rocks. Walks off the ice and then says, okay, we're done our practice. And everybody else is looking like Paul Trulson had just won the Olympic gold medals, looking like, what are these guys doing? And then needless to say, 2 games later, we picked up $90,000 in a Skins victory. So there's different ways to do everything, but that's one of my favorite stories, that you don't always have to, throw a million rocks up and down the sheet. You just got to be able to find ways to win when the time comes.
So, Wayne, we've asked our listeners to send in some questions this week, and this is an interesting one. It's kind of off in a different direction, but Chris Marino wants to have your thoughts about carving and how anyone never misses anymore with carving.
You know what? That's a great question, is because I'm working hard on that right now with almost every broom manufacturer and everyone who has an opinion to get truly how this works, as I never played with it on a regular basis before this year's Brier. And I'm going to tell you, I used it, Tim March came up and swept for me a few times at practice before the Brier, and I was amazed. And then we got out to the Brier, and my goal, probably similar to Kevin's or Glenn Howard's for sure, was I tried to throw every rock dead straight and as perfect as I could out of my hand. So when it left my hand, it was really close already. Then all of a sudden, I threw a couple this year at the Brier where I was a little wide, and I watched him March carve rocks 6-8 inches. Like, couldn't believe it. I let a hit go that I was sure I flashed wide, hit it right on the nose. So I am a big believer in carving. Now, because I've seen how it works, I want to understand how it works and what makes it the best. And Kevin and I have talked about this. We can't believe we didn't figure this out earlier. How did we not know this with all the years we played and all the curling we've done? How did we not know this works this way? So to answer his question is, yes, I believe it works, and yes, there has to be a better understanding. I still think the brooms are too effective. They shouldn't be that effective that a 75% curler can become a 90% curler simply because of sweeping.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting going forward for sure.
Well, Wayne, I got to ask you, at the time of recording, this is post-Toronto Maple Leafs losing. Are you a Leaf fan?
A huge Leaf, born and raised Leaf fan.
Maybe it was your fault.
I'm heartbroken.
It's only been a couple of years since they won last, hasn't it?
At least we didn't go like the Oilers and just roll over. Canucks did not even make the playoffs. But it hurt to watch them perform like that, and it hurt to watch Marner and Matthews not do anything, really. And I think it really shows how much of a leader Tavares was on and off the ice to the team.
Maybe they need Madaw to step in, a little consulting as a coach. Wayne, thanks a million. Thanks a million, man, for doing this, and good luck this afternoon, okay? I know you're busy working. Oh, no, you got a golf game.
I got a golf game with Glenn. I can hear him walking into my house upstairs, so I hope he's getting my clubs in his car.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot, Wayne. Appreciate you coming on.
Gentlemen, have a great day.
Well, Kevin, Wayne kind of behaved himself on the show. I was hoping I wanted to get some, you know, a little something out of him. But God, what a story, Kevin. He was, and he still loves the game, right? Crazy. He's going to be around, Kevin, for a long time.
No question. In coaching, and obviously can still play the game if he, you know, if the body would allow him. But yeah, a great guest to have, and certainly so knowledgeable, not just in, you know, throwing the rock or coaching, but just the idea of how the game should go forward into the future. And yeah, great to have Wayne on, and certainly terrific to have a few minutes of his time.
Warren, when you were running the events, the Briar, did Wayne give you any grief? Or was he pretty cool? Huh? Come on.
Oh, yes. Wayne and I had some interesting exchanges over time. I can think of a few, but no, we had a couple of discussions about a few things.
We got to have a show about grief that's been given to Warren Hansen, okay? We could have a whole week of shows. Anyway, great show. Thanks a lot to Wayne for coming on. And thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Warren. We've got a Zoom that we're doing this month in June. Inside Curling is reaching out to curling clubs wherever you are, all over the place. And we invite you to contact us and set up a Zoom call with me and Kevin and Warren to discuss anything you like. These have become very popular. And you really do get to tap into the great minds of Kevin and Warren. We do it on a limited basis and really only for, you know, for clubs, not individual people. So get in touch with us. Also, we're going to thank Rod Paulson and his company, In-House Strategies. They've been doing all the work on social media, and it's very active, and that's what's made the Facebook page and Twitter and Instagram so good. Thanks a lot to Warren. Thanks a lot to Andrew, our new producer today. Good to have him on board. Emil Delic has been helping out with this quite a bit, so has Jonathan Razzle. So another show in the books, fellas. Kev, Leaf fan?
It's all Oilers, baby.
Yeah, I know. You and I can hardly rib Leaf fans, Kevin. We got wiped out in Edmonton, four straight, and Warren can't. Vancouver never made the playoffs.
So. Hockey, what is that? What is hockey?
Yeah. What?
It's that other winter sport.
Yeah, what are playoffs? Yeah, good God. So, great show, fellas. Another one in the books. Thanks a lot to Wayne Madon, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Inside Curling.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jim.